thank you very much, first of all, to the Uhiro Foundation for sponsoring and to the Carnegie Council also for their contribution, and for the Uhiro Center for organizing this event and including me. I mean, one of the things that this event has been is just bringing together people from very different backgrounds and perspectives, and although we may all believe in the freedom of speech, none of us is ever compelled to hear one another, and so we wind up often going to conferences and workshops that where we hear the same thing from the same perspective, and it's really valuable just to be forced to put yourself in the mind frame of somebody else and something that's radically different. So thank you to everybody. All right, so I'll talk about this work that's been developed mainly in the book Privacy in Context, and here is the overview of what I'm going to do. First of all, I'll discuss a little bit of the rationale for contextual integrity. Then I will give you a super brief overview of the theory, and finally, I'll talk a little bit about contextual integrity and relativism. And I must say that that last bit is something that I decided I was going to talk about for this particular event, because it's a critique that's been raised of the theory again and again, and although I think I reckon with it, it seemed a useful moment to reckon with it very directly and confront it and see how I might respond to it, and I'll be eager to hear from you what you think. So this is probably something that many of you are already familiar with. This is what has gotten me to thinking about privacy for many years. I would say that privacy is one of the most persistent problems of the information age, and it's really interesting because it is philosophically interesting, it's really interesting from a legal and policy point of view, and it's also really interesting from a technical point of view. And so it's been looked at by many different members of this larger community, and in the book what I offer is, you know, what are some of the causes of moral panic, if you will, to say, oh my God, you know, our privacy has been violated by this information technology for all its amazing capacities. And I tried to divide it into these three different categories. This is what information technology and computing does really, really well, and at the same time raises privacy issues. One is the tracking and monitoring, and of course, you know, yesterday we learned about life logging, and I would put that in among this category of capacities that information technology offers us. We have aggregation and analysis, where we take data. The information technology gives us this amazing capacity to aggregate data from one source, from multiple sources, and then perform analysis, data mining, profiling of individuals, and so on, and here's some examples. And then finally, the capacity to publish and disseminate. And as we saw in David's presentation today, sometimes you can have a rule that affects what's being tracked and monitored, and that may not be problematic, but the problematic part from the point of view of privacy is the way the technology allows you to disseminate. And I don't want to say it's only a problem, I'm in a strong agreement with Bill over here. It's what's amazing about these technologies. And so I would say that the technologies and the internet, for example, are transformative, and not only socially, but in ways that affect or impinge upon some of our values. Now, oops. Let's see, maybe I'm not pressing hard enough.
Can you just check the
thing?
Yes.
I'm not getting this to respond to me. I was pressing too hard. So many theories of privacy will try to define privacy as they'll conceptualize privacy, and when they try and capture what might be wrong with some of these activities that I just had on up on the screen for you, they might say that because privacy is control over information, these constitute losses of control, or they have a conception of privacy as access to information, personal information understood as David was talking about this morning. And when you have a technology that reveals more information, this is a threat to privacy. And I call that a secrecy model of privacy. And many, of course, understand that you can't go around, you know, there's no, you can't give people, or you can't defend a right to control information absolutely. And so the way they try to moderate this right to control, or a right to keep people at a certain distance, diminish access or secrecy, is to say, well, okay, not over all information about yourself, but let's divide the world into this dichotomy of private and public, and we'll give you some protections over private information and not public information, or private spaces and not public spaces, or we'll have rules that govern government action but not those in the private sector. This happened in 1974 in the United States when the Privacy Act was passed. And again, you know, thanks to David for elaborating some of this. I do argue about, and I won't develop those arguments here, that these conceptions are problematic for a number of points of perspectives, but partly what I was trying to get at is, you know, in technical terms, what freaks people out about these mechanisms that we looked at earlier. And what I came up with is that a conception of privacy, if you will, as a right to appropriate flow of information. That's what people care about, and that's what they get upset about when this appropriate flow is violated. And in saying that, the theory says nothing is up for grabs. Every piece of information, every circumstance, context, and so on, there is a demand for appropriate flow of information. So, of course, you might say, what is appropriate flow of information? And the theory itself is actually a development of that notion. It's to understand what we mean by it, flow, and the answer basically is appropriate flow is a flow that's in accordance with what I call in the book informational norms. And the key context, the key concepts that I developed in order to give an account of that are context, norm, actor, information type, and transmission principle, and I'll develop these quickly here for you today. So one of the concepts that we need to use in this theory is context. I'm not developing this notion of, I use the word context, but really I'm building on intuitions that have been developed much more deeply in fields in social theory and in social philosophy, this notion that when we act and transact in society, we're not acting and transacting in undifferentiated social space, but we're acting and transacting in different social contexts. So we here today are in a conference, in an educational setting. We're acting and transacting within an educational context. When you would visit your healthcare provider, you would be in a healthcare context. When you go to the voting polls and the booths and you cast your vote, you're acting in a political environment, friends and family, when you're at home, at a dinner, and so on. Now, there are various characteristics of the context that are quite important. Here are some of the basic features of that characterize different contexts, and in particular, there are norms that govern all sorts of actions and transactions in a context, and of course we're going to be focusing on those norms that I argue govern the flow of information in context, but there are these other characteristics of context that are quite important. And another characteristic that I want to mention is that contexts differ from culture to culture. So it may be that in different eras and in different cultures, in different societies, in different nations, there may be differences in how we carve up the context. The healthcare context, for example, might look very different, the educational context. And even in somewhat similar societies, there can be differences in these kinds of contexts. And in a way, you know, that's how it should be. You know, so, oh, I'm jumping ahead of myself. So you have these different contexts, and they can be different. They can nest, they can overlap, they can conflict with one another, and so on. So I'll be talking about context, and I might talk about family context, and someone from India might come up to me and say, you know, in India, it's not so much about the nuclear family, but it's more about the extended family and their differences. How do you take those sorts of things into consideration? Now, among the norms, as I mentioned, the norms that I was particularly interested in were what I called informational norms, and then called them context-relative informational norms, because there would be different sets of norms that would apply to the flow of information in different contexts. So the key variables of these informational norms are actors, and now what a norm might determine or might govern the flow of information from one actor to another actor about a third actor, and in some cases the information subject may be the same, often is the same as the sender of the information. Also, what matters is the information type. So what type of information? Now, if you have theories that deal with dichotomies, then you would scratch your head and say, oh, IP addresses. Is IP address private or public? And you would, you know, go round and round in circles figuring out if this is private, you know, if this is sensitive or not. But in this approach, you would just say, what are the norms governing, or what should be the norms governing IP addresses? That seems to be a relevant type of information in a certain context. And a third variable in this, and this is something that there are other theories that talk about actors' roles and information types, but this notion of a transmission principle is often hidden from view. And so I want to just talk a little bit about what counts as a transmission principle, and then I'm going to do a lot of examples, and so hopefully some of this will become clear when I give some examples. So a transmission principle is, let's think about it as the constraint that governs the flow of information from one actor to another. So when you share information with your physician about some, let's say you have a pain in your abdomen, you would go, you would visit the physician and you would describe the details of your condition. You would understand that the terms, at least in the United States, and way back, you know, Hippocratic Oath, that you would be sharing this information under conditions of confidentiality. So you would be sharing with your physician, you know that your physician is not going to share it beyond. So that's a transmission principle. Now, when you're talking with your physician, you might say to your physician, how are you today? And the physician will not then begin to talk about the pain in his or her abdomen. So there isn't really clear reciprocity in that relationship, whereas if you're hanging out with your friend at a coffee shop and you're talking about your latest romance, then you kind of expect that kind of reciprocity about similar types of information. So reciprocity is one. Sometimes we understand that we're selling information, and in some cases we don't believe that certain types of information should be subjected to marketplace norms. And when you're in a court of law and you're under oath, then you are compelled to provide certain types of information, and that too. Now, the one characteristic sometimes, and in many circumstances, we believe that we invest the subject with a right to volunteer the information, and that's the many cases in which we might say that you have a right to control information. So control then becomes, it's still important, but it's simply one of the transmission principles in this larger scheme of contextual integrity. So all right. So I wanted to just give an example. Sometimes these norms are understood; they're implicit in our relationship. So if you're again sitting and chatting with a friend in a coffee shop, and you're talking about your latest romantic entanglements, and then you hear that your friend has posted it on her blog, you feel your friendship has been violated. And this is a problem, but there's no law that says that your friend has broken the law. Yeah, I'm sure there are conditions in which you could say that. But in some instances, and this is really what I've been doing with some of the collaborations that I'm involved in, is looking at certain laws and actually seeing with some gratification that the structure of the law does is modeled by contextual integrity. So this is an example that comes from US law, and the Gramm-Leach-Bliley Act was passed in order to enable certain types of corporations to merge, and as a result of these mergers, there was great concern about the information that was held by these different types of companies, in particular financial institutions like insurance companies and banks and so forth. And so the Federal Trade Commission developed a set of privacy rules that was an interpretation of one of the aspects, and this comes from that. And so I just wondered, you see that when you look at one of these privacy rules that emerged out of the FTC rulemaking from the Gramm-Leach-Bliley Act, you in fact see that it cares about all those aspects of the rule and needs to specify those when it writes down its rules governing the flow of information among financial institutions. Julian, what time did we start?
We've been going 16 minutes.
Oh, okay. So okay. Slow down. Now, wait a sec. How did I... Okay, so I wanted to talk a little bit about some of the work that I've been doing with a student named Kei Tatiyama on privacy in Japan. We know from some early conferences, you know, Lucas and I went to some conferences in Japan, that privacy has often been a concern of Japanese philosophers who we've spoken to and understand just Japanese commentaries in general, who would say that privacy is not an indigenous concept, but rather it's a concept that's been imported from the West, and that Japan has been maybe forced to accept certain kinds of rules imposed upon them as maybe the cost of doing business or participating in the global economy, and that's maybe because that is true from the rulemaking point of view. Now, what contextual integrity says is, if you understand privacy a little bit differently, then it would be just obvious to you that every culture, and I'm not a historian, every culture has norms that govern the flow of information in all the different contexts that make up these societies. And so we wanted to see, well, what is indigenous? There've got to be rules. Every society talks about gossip and what you can and cannot see and so forth. And so it's been really interesting. We've gone back to certain ancient texts, and she's doing this research and just talking to me about it, and going back to the 9th, 10th, 11th, 12th century, and seeing that in these ancient societies, there are expressions already of the information flows that are prohibited in those societies. Who can see what, who can say what, and so on. And I think that when you go back to those kinds of moments, you can begin to see that every culture has some of these rules, and it might be a good idea to start building on some of these building these rules to understand where the norms come from. Now, the claim here is that contextual integrity is preserved when entrenched norms are respected and violated when entrenched norms, and again, context-relative informational norms, it's violated when these norms are not respected. But, and this is this was a challenge to the theory, and I have to say that the theory developed in various stages. So I had this, and I was speaking to Phil Agri, and he said, and this is, by the way, why I went back and read a lot of Edmund Burke, and he said to me, "Oh my God, that is such a conservative theory. Do you really mean to say that entrenched norms must always govern the flow of information? What about new flows? You're always going to reject especially those ways in which information technology has, I mean, you may say it disrupted, but there are obviously many instances in which the new flows of information are better. They improve life. So, for example, we know that greater access to information, be it for political purposes or to check out a surgeon who's about to perform heart surgery on you, these are improvements in our lives. And if you insist that the norms that are entrenched due to whatever restrictions might have been imposed by the natural characteristics of the natural world, this would be problematic for the theory. You know, what do I do here? Do I dig in my heels or do I try to figure something out? And it seemed to me that this was really an opportunity to entrench, ground contextual integrity, give it an ethical, give it moral weight. So we ask, how do you bring prescriptive character rather than merely a descriptive character to contextual integrity? And this then becomes a rather major part of the theory, and I'm just running through the steps here. By the way, the theory of contextual integrity, one of the things that it does is it offers an analysis, but I'm really concerned about contextual integrity serving as a decision heuristic, both for the designers of a technology. So, you know, if I were going to design Facebook, I'll tell you what I think the rules should be. You know, well, afterwards. And if I'm advising the Federal Trade Commission, you know, they now have this new initiative, Do Not Track, you know, how would contextual integrity speak to the Federal Trade Commission as they try to develop a new set of regulations, or they try and propose a new set of regulations for actors in the online environment? So it has that component to it. Now, I remain conservative, and my the first step is to say that the presumption favors entrenched norms, but challenge is possible. And one of the reasons that I do presume in favor of entrenched rules is that in many instances, and I'm always like qualifying before I'm saying what I'm going to say. In many instances, the rules that we live by are rules that, and this is very Burkean, the rules have evolved over centuries. And so when you look at a rule that governs the flow of information in certain contexts, ancient contexts, families, friends, they have evolved they're settled accommodations that have settled some of the conflicts and trouble spots and so on in these interactions, maybe power relationships, so between the government between, say, in liberal democracies, you would have government and individual, and there's such an imbalance of power that you eventually evolve to a rule that limits access of government to individual information as a means of, like, leveling the playing field. And so the first thing to say is that if you have this rule, there could be some really interesting and important reasons why this rule is entrenched. That doesn't mean that challenge isn't possible, and, you know, feminists and cultural theorists often will challenge me for saying this. Now, what we need to do when we do a nevertheless, we may need to challenge some of these entrenched rules. And what I've proposed is that you do a kind of comparative assessment. First, you want to understand, and now you're doing this comparatively. Let's imagine that take something like a heart rate monitor. We're going to introduce a new heart rate monitor that's much more comprehensive and gives you much greater detail, and it allows you to broadcast it to everybody in the hospital, not just the nurse who happens to walk into the room at that time. So we say the first thing that contextual integrity allows you to do, and I think here already it gives you a much more fine grain and immediate access, is to compare the flows of information in these two different cases. And sometimes you would just immediately pick up, it would reveal differences that other approaches frankly can't give you. So when Google Maps Street View came out, the defenders of Google Maps Street View said, well, what's the problem? You're in public, and this is just capturing information that's in public. How can that be a privacy problem? Now, if you do the analysis using this kind of normative structure, you can immediately see that the flows of information have been radically affected by it's not simply being in, for example, reciprocity. When you're walking around and there's no camera involved, you know, I would be walking in a park for the most part. I would see you. You would see me. Whereas if I have a camera somewhere and I'm taking your picture and then I'm broadcasting it somewhere else or somebody else, then we can see that the flow of information has been radically disrupted. And it doesn't matter that you're in a public place or not. So it gives you a kind of lens through which to see the changes in ways that it wasn't easy to see before. So when you're assessing the impacts, the suggestion here is that you're assessing them also in ethical terms. So you're observing that the new heart rate monitor gives you different kinds of information, it disrupts the flow, but you say that it's beneficial. It's ultimately beneficial. That's it. There's no problem with this. We can see that the new flows are better. It doesn't matter that it changes the flows. The end. So that could, just in itself, revealing the differences can sometimes be quite easy. Now in most of the cases, of course, that we're paying attention to, in fact, the heart rate monitor I particularly raised because there's probably not a single theorist of privacy who has ever even considered the new kinds of medical sensing devices that have been developed as anything to do with privacy, because they are kind of obvious. But in this model, any kind of disruption of flow is perhaps a cause for asking questions.
15 minutes.
Left. Okay. Now I'm going to pay attention to this. Thank you. What next? So let's look now at some of the cases that have been more problematic and have taxed us more in our thinking about privacy. In many instances, there is an indeterminacy. And there's an indeterminacy in that. Okay, let me back up. in many instances, most of the instances that we're thinking about, when we look at the consequences or the impact of introducing a certain technology, the impacts are not as clear in ethical terms. Now, when Facebook, for example, introduced Beacon, which is the service that would in which cooperating businesses would inform Facebook of what you might have bought at, say, Amazon or even local real world, if you will, companies, and then broadcast to your friends what you bought, this caused an outcry. And it's sort of odd because Facebook was so taken by surprise with it, many of us would have predicted that this is exactly how people would respond. And you might say, how should we be thinking about cases like that? Because you could argue that perhaps it was offensive to me and I didn't want Lucas, say, to know what I had just bought. Facebook might argue that this is beneficial for them because this was an important source of income and this kept them going. So many of the cases currently, say, behavioral advertising that we heard about yesterday, you have the ad networks saying that this encourages advertisers to invest more in the internet, and so you might not like your activities being tracked across websites, but this enables the advertisers, it gives them more courage to consider that their investments in advertising will bring greater returns. And so these issues are always extremely complex, with different parties being affected in different ways. And so what often happens is what we heard this morning, privacy theorists are forced into this position where they would say, we must balance. We understand that your concern with some change in flow gives rise to your call for greater restrictiveness, but say, security at the airport is going to be greatly benefited from this particular new attempt to read more into people. And so you often get into these circumstances. Currently in the United States, there's a huge push, the Obama administration, to digitize healthcare information and introduce things like health information exchanges and so forth, which would encourage far greater flow and sharing of information, but at the same time, huge privacy concerns. So they're just, and why? Because public health would be greatly benefited and so on. So the step that contextual integrity says, whoa, not so fast. You don't need to balance yet. What you need to do is step back and look at the context and say, what are the ends and the purposes and the values internal to those contexts, and what is the significance or the meaning of these costs and benefits, these different rights in that context? And once and that will sometimes then reveal the path to a particular policy. And so again, I want to give you, I'm just using an example that I think many of us will have intuitions about. So for example, when we think about something like voting in a popular election, we have incredible rules that govern the flow of information in that environment. And because, well, compared with, say, members of Congress voting on some kind of a bill, and why is that? Why you can do the argument that says that you must vote autonomously, and this provides the individual with the ability to act freely, and you can have all this concern and weigh the pros and cons and so forth. But ultimately, what contextual integrity would, the way it would lead you through this argument, is to say that in a democracy, in a liberal democracy, what you want is for each person's vote. That's the theory. Each person should have a vote, should vote autonomously. And so it's not only that your individual rights are being protected in with rules like this, it's that the health of the democracy is protected. And if you have healthcare information, if you don't protect people, the confidentiality of people's information, people may not go see doctors. They may not have themselves tested for HIV. They may go doctor hopping. They may lie to their doctors. All strategies that are known for people to take, and that would diminish the achievement of the goals of the healthcare context. So it's not only that you're protecting the individual against harm, it's that you're promoting the ends and values of the context. And so that's what the argument says. Don't balance yet. First run it through this particular filter. So here are the features. It often makes salient the roots of controversies, reveals what's at stake, and this theory also offers grounds for a decision heuristic. So let me jump to, I probably have about 5 minutes left, let me just jump to why people have been concerned about contextual integrity as maybe leaning in the direction of moral relativism. One was what I alluded to earlier, which is that different societies have different contexts and they look different. And so you're going to see different informational norms. And in very trivial ways, as someone who's moved from one country to another, I would remark on things like, oh, in South Africa, your grades would be published. We came to the United States, and this, your grades were only known to you and the instructor, and nobody else should know what your grades are. So there would be these different rules, and perhaps that is a source of relativism, but I think anybody in practical ethics, this for me anyway, I don't think this is a very difficult one, because we can all believe in similar principles, but that, you know, on the ground you may embody these principles in different, or you may give them different concrete expression, even though we might agree on the principles. The more tricky one is, I think, the second one, and it also reveals a little bit more to you about the nature of contextual integrity as a theory, and that is that, and I don't know how better to put it, but that moral force is mediated through context. The moral weight is of any particular norm, say there's a rule that declares that information should flow in a certain way. The value or the correctness of this rule is, and the way it settles moral conflicts is to refer this conflict to the values, ends, and purposes in a context. And so that means that you're using the context, as I mentioned, as a filter for the rules. And therefore, if you have a context that is problematic in certain ways, so that if the ends, purposes, and values of the context are problematic, you're using that as a standard to measure the rules. And so it introduces a kind of relativism into your understanding of privacy, because contexts themselves can be variable within different cultures and different societies and across the ages, and some who might be seeking more universal standards for privacy, a more universal footing for privacy, might be concerned at this kind of relativity. Now, I mean, the one thing that I would end by saying is that I feel that is actually how it should be, because context can be up for grabs. We can still say, okay, this is a liberal democracy. These are the ends, purposes, and values of this liberal democracy. I mean, right now we're doing a major study on the placement of court records online, and we're having to investigate things about what are the basic functions or purposes of the courts and what are the values that the courts subscribe to in a liberal democracy and so forth, and you find yourself looking at that rather than focusing on the rules. So if you live in a totalitarian regime versus a liberal democracy, you're going to find that the rules that the context endorses are going to be different. And that's going to then push you to examine the context. And that's actually as it should be. So let me give you a different example, because I was interested in psychoanalysis as a subfield of the healthcare context, and I talk a little bit about that in the book. In some areas or some forms of psychoanalysis, the psychoanalyst doesn't even take notes. That's how important it is. The understanding here is that the talking is the therapy itself. So that if you're going to inhibit anything that goes on in this psychoanalytic environment, you're going to diminish the value of the activity itself. And so psychoanalysts have been, you know, really staunch holdouts in this notion that you must record information, and if you hold into court and, you know, is this person capable of murder? Tell us what he discussed in his... They won't, because that, to them, that totally will destroy the psychotherapeutic content. Now, if this is, as a society, we insist that psychoanalysts do take notes and do reveal that information, we risk the possibility of the psychoanalytic context itself being destroyed. And so instead of focusing on what the rules should be, this theory says, you know, you have to evaluate the context and say, are the purposes that are served by this context valuable to society? And what about the values of this particular manifestation of the context? Is this something to uphold? And so the rules we have that constrain information flow are not only for the protection of the individual. Privacy is not only for the protection of the individual, but it's for the protection of social integrity itself. That's what's at stake. And so when we ask these kinds of questions about relativity or relativism, the answer is yes, it is. It does have a relativistic character, but it can still be universalist and allow you to do the analysis, but it happens somewhere else.